Thank you for tuning in to The Global Novel. I'm Claire Hennessy. Little Nemo in Slumberland is a comic strip created by American cartoonist Winsor McCay. It depicts Nemo having fantastic dreams that were interrupted by his awakening in the final panel. The strip is considered McCay's masterpiece for his experiments with the form of the comics page. Its use of color and perspective, its timing and pacing, the size and shape of its panels, and its architectural and other details. With me today is Professor Scott Buchantman, who is a cultural theorist and professor of film and media studies at Stanford University. His research explores how such popular media as film, comics, and animation mediate between new technologies and human perceptual and bodily experience. Among many of his works on these subjects, The Poetics of Slumberland, Animated Spirits and the Animating Spirit celebrates play, plasmatic possibility, and the life of images in cartoons, comics, and cinema. Welcome to The Global Novel, Scott.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Claire. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Great. To begin with, Little Nemo in Slumberland featured the young Nemo, which in Latin means no one, who dreamed himself into wondrous predicaments from which he awoke in bed in the last panel. Could you share more on the overall concept of this major storytelling frame?
So McCay was a really prolific cartoonist in the early days of newspaper cartooning, and he did, I think, at least a dozen different strips, and one of his most popular was called Dreams of the Rarebit Fiend, which would be about the dreams of adults who had eaten this really, like, cheesy meal right before going to bed, and then they would have these really strange dreams of metamorphosis, of a lady holding an alligator purse that turns into a real alligator and chases her away and things like that. And then Little Nemo in Slumberland came along just slightly later than that. And in a way, it's a version of Rarebit Fiend for kids. The kid doesn't eat anything. The kid doesn't do anything. Nemo only dreams. Sometimes in the very early strips, you'll see him at the beginning saying goodnight to his grandfather or something. But most of the time, we just have him in his dream world, in Slumberland, having adventures with some of the other characters there. But at the end of every episode, which would be one full page of a Sunday newspaper, and honestly, I'm not exaggerating, it would be something like that tall. At the end of that page, he would wake up, having usually fallen out of bed and calling for his mama or saying, oh, what a weird dream or something. So it was just every week, this full-color comic that just let McCay's imagination just go crazy with wonderful metamorphoses and adventures and the like.
Was this read by children, adults, or both? Do you think they would get the same things from the experience of reading it?
Yeah, I like that question because I would come at it two ways. One is, just like once upon a time, cartoons were for everybody because they were the things that showed before the main movie. So if a family went to the movies, everybody watched the cartoon. It wasn't just for kids, but many of them were aimed more at a kid's audience. With Nemo, kids and adults would definitely read it. Why not? It's staring you in the face in your beautiful, five Sunday newspaper. But where I think that the kids would sort of just go along with the fantasy and just really relish identifying with Nemo and just seeing themselves in the strip, I think that adults then and now need a little bit more help in letting their imaginations go free. So to have a comic strip with a kid, so it's not about an adult, it's about a kid, and the adult can say, oh, well, this is fiction. I don't need to really take this very seriously. And yet, nevertheless, having a kid there becomes a sort of opens a door for the adult to sort of have some of that same imaginative play and pleasure that their kids are just having over on the floor right there without even thinking about it. Like, Nemo becomes the excuse. So in a way, I think, in many ways, it's a strip that's just as aimed at adults as any other Winsor McCay strip. But because it has a child, it sort of licenses the adult to let his fancy go free.
Right. You mentioned in your book that newspapers were the main venue where most comic strips were published and received at the time. What did comics bring to newspapers, and what was it like for readers to read the comic strip at the time?
Right. Well, so what I used to think was that what comics brought to newspapers was color. Like, here's your drab old newspaper with columns of type and, you know, typeset lettering and, you know, black and white. If there are images at all, they're black and white images. This is back, you know, before color printing. So in all those ways, I thought, well, and there come Sunday color comics, and that burst of color is amazing. But it turns out that there was a whole Sunday color supplement in the bigger newspapers. And then, you know, this started in New York, but quickly got syndicated around the country, where you would get a Sunday supplement that might have comics for sure, but it might also have reports from fashion shows. It might have interesting photography experiments or big illustrations showing how New York would look after an earthquake, you know, just all kinds of things like that. And so, you know, there was plenty of color there. So I was thinking, so what was it that comics actually did add to the mix? Because I was convinced they added something. And I came up with two things. One, they added stability. Unlike all these other supplements, every week you would get Little Nemo or Crazy Cat or Maggie and Jiggs and Bringing Up Father or any of a number of the other characters or Walt and Skeezix in Gasoline Alley. And some of these had continuing stories. So you would come back to the paper every day or every week for the next installment. And in fact, comics popularity really enhanced newspaper circulation. The more popular your comics, the more people were buying your newspaper. So this kept people coming back over and over. The other thing I think they gave is what I call their prankishness, because so many early comics feature things like the Cats and Jammer Kids with them, like, I don't know, tying sticks of firecrackers to the waistcoat of the inspector, one of the adults in their lives, and setting them off and getting spanked at the end, and then next week they would pull another trick on somebody else, and it never ended really well for them, but then, you know, they came back the next week ready to do it again. So I think they added a kind of playful spirit to the newspaper that really worked against the kind of, you know, capital letters, this is important stuff that you need to know. Here was a little playground for the reader, be they adult or child. Here was a little respite from the day. Here was a little reverie that could just let people have fun for a moment before getting back to the important stuff. Yeah.
Well, I always find it useful to learn a little about the context in which a certain work was created and received. Could you please share a little about Little Nemo's Americanness? Especially, you mentioned in your book that even though American comic strips were influenced by European comic strips, they also developed their unique styles, one of which is this notion called disobedient machine. Can you explain this notion a little bit, and how does Little Nemo in Slumberland embody this prominent aspect of Americanness?
Mm-hmm. It's important to remember that McKay, at the same time that he's doing all of these comic strips, also becomes one of the first people to animate drawings. And he had a vaudeville act, so he would perform on stage on a bill with other performers in New York, and he would draw lightning sketches. Someone would tell him to draw something, and he would draw it, or he would just show marvelous ways that he could, because he was like a drawing. The first character that he introduces, well, his first animated cartoon, he animates his Little Nemo characters. He did this in 1911. And so he would do his vaudeville act, whatever it was, drawing and interacting with the audience. And then somewhere towards the end of the act or at the end of his act, he would show this 2-minute animation of his characters moving. And he didn't invent animated cartoons, but his figures were the most fully rendered. They existed against a blank background, but they still just sort of had roundness and three-dimensionality and depth to them. They spin around, they fall down, they do all these movements. And Then his next creation is a character named Gertie the Dinosaur. And this is part of an act that he was doing around 1914. The Little Nemo stuff was more like 1911. So in his act, he would introduce, he would talk about, you know, the impossibility of us ever knowing what dinosaurs are like until now. And then on the big screen behind him, he would say, "Come on out, Gertie," and Gertie the Dinosaur would come out and interact with McKay in real time. It was, I'm sure, it was an astounding act. An animation historian named John Canemaker has recreated the act, but I've never seen it. But for me, there's a key moment where he says, where Gertie snaps at him when he tries to reach or do something. He sort of snaps at his fingers and he says, "Oh, Gertie, shame on you. You're a bad girl." And Gertie begins to cry. And I'm really interested. I'm really interested in that. And so is everybody else who's ever thought about early animation. This doesn't just come from me. But that the idea that early animated beings disobey their creators. This starts to happen a lot. There's a whole series of cartoons in the 20s. It goes further than that, but it starts in the late teens. The Out of the Inkwell series, where Max Fleischer, the animator, would be on screen. He would draw Coco the Clown, and Coco would have some adventures. But very often, it would be like, "Okay, time to get back in the inkwell, Coco." And Coco would be like, "No," and try to, like, run away. And what is it? What is it about early animated creations? And these are American. I mean, there's earlier animated cartoons in Europe, but they're not playing with that same idea. But what's happening in America that, the animator creates a being that by definition they have complete control over, and that being then disobeys them. And so I coined this term, the disobedient machine, because it seemed that when Gertie walks out on stage, and by the way, there are films of these now that show McKay making the drawings and setting it all up, but when Gertie walks out on stage, the audience believes that this being has life. It moves, it breathes, you know, it has life. It's a great illusion. But when Gertie snaps at Winsor McKay, or when Coco doesn't want to go back in the bottle, right, what they prove is that they have a life of their own. Right. They have a life of their own. They have will. They're autonomous. Right. And the illusion that they now have their own being is really profound. So I think this sense of assertion, and if you move up through the history of animation, you know, you get to Pinocchio in 1940, mm-hmm, with Pinocchio, who wants to become a real boy. What's the first thing he does? He doesn't go to school like his father told him to do. He disobeys all over the place. And you could say that at the end of Pinocchio, he learns his lesson. He learns to be a good boy. He's reunited with his family and everybody's happy. But I would argue that it is his disobedience that actually makes him a real boy. I have an 11-year-old, and believe me, disobedience is what makes you a real boy. So I'm just sort of fascinated by this long history of the disobedient machine that I find even outside of cartoons as well. But I can stop there.
Right. Well, based on your notion of disobedient machine, could you explain your main argument in the book, which I thought is fascinating?
Yeah, so, well, building off this disobedient machine question, I have become really interested in ideas of play and of playfulness, which is something that isn't always taken seriously in the world of academia. Mm-hmm. Pleasure and play are things that don't get quite as much attention as perhaps they should, or at least as I think they should. And I am just drawn to things like comics, the kind of comics we've been talking about, animation, early animation, but many, many different kinds of animation, superhero media, physical comedy, musicals with, you know, singing and dancing bodies, and all of these ways that bodies get to behave in the world in ways that our bodies can't. And I just really am taken with those kinds of configurations where bodies can fly and morph and dance and sing, many, all, none of which I can do. So the book becomes an exploration of some of these phenomena or some of these characters that matter to have that. So the idea of the disobedient machine, which I find to be not... Like, the disobedient machine is not dangerous. It's not like King Kong or Frankenstein's monster who will destroy us if they get free. No, it's more like they're just going to make a little mischief and then they will, you know, do what they need to do. And, you know, I think this is important in culture. Some might say, well, that's just a very easy way for a society to be able to let off steam. It doesn't have any, it doesn't make any real change. It doesn't get people to really think about the world differently. But I'm not so sure that's true. The Soviet filmmaker Sergei Eisenstein wrote a wonderful book on Disney, and he talked about what he called the plastic nature of these characters and these stories. He talked about Alice in Wonderland, for example. Mm-hmm. And he said, wow, you know, I'm not quoting exactly, but he found that this, what he called the freedom from once and forever allotted form, to be really profound. And he tries to cover it up by sort of saying, you know, and you can understand how American workers would really need to have this sense that things could be different, that, you know, what you are now isn't necessarily what you have to be, and that, you know, these things allow you to think about the possibility of change. Well, I tend to think Soviet industrial workers and American industrial workers were probably suffering under the same sort of conditions of production. So I would say that, you know, this is a broader thing than just American, but this idea that something could be different, that change is a possibility. And I think this is at the core of my love of superhero stuff, which doesn't mean I like all superhero stuff, believe me. But again, this idea of a freedom from once and forever allotted form, a sense that things could be different. One of my favorite academic writers, a guy named Richard Dyer, and I've been quoting this essay called Entertainment and Utopia everywhere in my writing and teaching these days. And he says that, yeah, entertainment has a utopian aspect, but that doesn't make it an escape. It doesn't make it useless. It does allow the imagination to imagine other possibilities, to imagine that things could be different than what they are, and that things could be, could move in a different direction. It's a temporary solution. It's an idealistic solution. It's not a real solution, but it speaks to real conditions of dissatisfaction that people might have with the world that they live in. So no, they don't produce direct change, but they keep alive the sense that imagination is important, and imaginative possibility has to exist before real change can exist. So these are some of the things that the book tracks out. And of course, I talk about early animation, early comics. Superheroes show up at the end, they have to. But I also talk about things like My Fair Lady and musicals and, you know, many other things. So, yeah.
Right. As you just pointed out, like other comic strips created at the time, Little Nemo demonstrates a similar set of rhetorics of play and playfulness. When we read a work of art like Little Nemo in Slumberland, what happens with our mode of absorbing information?
I think comics ask you to do a lot when you read comics. We don't always think that's true because anybody can read comics. Many people grow up reading comics, even if it's just Archie or whatever. But nevertheless, you know, here are a series of pictures with a gap between each of them. And you have to sort of understand that they exist in a sequence, that the words that are there are coming out of those characters' mouths. So this is what they're saying. How long a gap there is between one panel and the next is up in the air. It might be no time at all. It might be 2 years, like the cut from a bone to a spaceship in 2001, A Space Odyssey. It could be tens of thousands of years. So you have to sort of synthesize words and images that sort of are simple enough to act like words, and words that are drawn big and sound effects-y so they look like pictures. And you have to sort of synthesize all this information. But I think we learn to do it. I think we learn to do it pretty easily. But then as we get older, if you keep reading comics, you find artists who find incredibly inventive ways to play with all those elements of form and structure. So the reading of comics can be quite challenging. Mm-hmm. So with Little Nemo in Slumberland, for example, McKay, I think, I can't find an earlier example of someone who does this. He will, for example, in the second episode of Little Nemo, Nemo goes in his dream down into a mushroom forest. Mm-hmm. And as he goes down and down into the forest and it gets deeper and deeper, the panels that McKay is using.
We hope you have enjoyed the episode so far. If you want to hear the entire episode, you can subscribe at theglobalnovel.com/subscribe. Thank you so much for listening.